Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Tom, it is upon us. It is here.
Season 17, first episode in the books.
This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, you are off to a rip-roaring start. There were some surprises. There was some stuff that was absolutely predictable. Gregory is a juggernaut. I think we saw some interesting jockeying. We saw a little California beach cooking. And this is going to be very interesting.
A lot of teams. I was very confused. There's a lot of teams trying to figure out who is on who and first team, second team, third team. But
yeah, traditionally when you have to go to the non-primary color apron, the aqua, the chartreuse, the fuchsia, the periwinkle, like there are a lot of teams.
A lot of teams, but I'm excited to see everyone back at work here. And Gail looks great after missing
so
last season.
Nice to see Gail. She can characterize with one sentence everything you need to know about a dish. She is the most precise judge in terms of just general review and appraisal. She's super cool. She is earnest, and I love earnest, as you know, Tom. In the age of snark, I am a proponent of earnestness. So
glad to have her back.
Glad to have her back. We started at Griffith Park Observatory. Opening shot, just right over the hill. You can actually see the observatory from my home, and there was going to be a mise en place challenge. We were going to see who's going to be James Dean and who's going to be Sal Mineo at the Griffith Observatory. This was interesting, and I love Kevin Gillespie's explanation because, like, you know, who, like, the favorites kind of had trouble in this challenge, and Kevin kind of described it as he has the PFTS for the kind of work that the judges demanded, which is people for that shit. So it was kind of interesting, Tom, to see the name celebrity chef sort of like wilt under the cracking of almonds, whereas those who have more immediate experience with prep were just ripping shit up.
Yeah, like, look at that third team, the last team. It was Gregory, Eric, Jen, Leanne, and Angelo. That's a monster team. That's a great team. So to your point, it felt like you know, maybe some of the best chefs in the power rank, their average power ranking, probably would be the third team, right? Like, that is a strong team there.
Right. So, I mean, we had, you know, at the end, yeah, Gregory and Eric. So you had basically number one and three on your board, one and four on my board. And, you know,
how would you shuck an almond?
I have no
How would you crack
idea.
An almond?
Yeah. But, you know, when Brian was talking about that little toy soldier nutcracker, like, my grandfather had something akin to that. I don't think it was a soldier, but it was just like the massive nutcracker on that wooden bowl. And those almonds have been there since like 1949.
Collecting dust.
Exactly.
Yes.
That no one ever touches. Yeah, and in the there was an advantage. Finishing early got the red team a little bit of a head start. The items were an artichoke, citrus, and almond. So that is going to be the base of the quick fire. And, you know, we got the first glimpse of who these chefs are and what they want to do. It started with the red team. That was Sasto, Kevin, Melissa, Voltaggio, and Jamie. They were,
but it might
no,
almost,
no, no, no. I'm sorry. It was Blue who finished first, right?
No, it was Red. Oh, right, team right, Red right. finished first, and Voltaggio almost didn't get in that first team. He tried very, very hard to be on that first team.
Yeah. So,
two early checks.
Right. Yeah. So that was a little interesting. I think there should have been some penalty for having the judges.
You should be in a penalty box.
Yeah,
you have to like wait for 30
exactly,
seconds before you
exactly.
get back in.
So, you know, it's interesting. And so we have our first glimpse also, not just of the chefs themselves in Quickfire, but kind of how they're going to function on a team, right? You get a little glimpse of who's the asshole, who's accommodating, who's the sort of assertive, take charge person who doesn't offend, who are the wallflowers, who are the accommodationists. Very interesting human dynamic, especially given that, as you say, this is an all-star season and you ain't brought back unless you're like Jen Carroll and you're willing to go tell the judges to go fuck themselves, or you're Lisa, you're willing to tell everybody to go fuck themselves. I mean, by and large, they choose strong personalities because it's a competition reality show and you want strong personalities.
And I feel bad for Joe here because right off the bat, Brian Malarkey just takes the wheel. Even though he's not the captain of the team, he basically tells Joe, hey, here's the dish you're going to make.
Wait, are we talking about we're still on the elimination or we're still in the quickfire or the elimination?
Well, we're going with the quick right after the quickfire when those teams are sorted out. I kind of felt like when you start to see those teams take shape and the dynamics within those teams and who is the alpha and who takes over, that team with, not to jump the gun, I didn't know if you were going to go at this point, but Joe kind of sat there and listened as Brian was like, Malarkey said, hey, why don't you do a flatbread clam pizza? And he was like, okay, I guess I'll do that.
So back to the quick fire. So it was interesting because everybody was sort of on their best behavior right at first, right? And so we had, you know, it was sort of the get to know you. Everybody's kind of sniffing each other out.
Yeah.
We got Kevin. We got Sasto, Melissa, Voltaggio, Jamie. Really strong group out of the box. By the way, Melissa showing strong early on. I got to tell you, of the sort of middle of the pack judge contestants, Melissa's telling strong. So they go with the char grilled artichoke with the sumac yogurt and tahini. Tom, it is the year of sumac. I don't know if you've noticed it in your eating experiences. Everybody is doing sumac. We're sort of in a moment of elevated Middle Eastern and sumac, that deep red, the tangy, almost citrusy flavor. You see it in all that za'atar you're seeing on everything. So they come out with that. And then, of course, Tom, what's Joe Sasto going to do? in a quick fire challenge?
What looks like big tortellini.
He doing pasta. And as Tom Colicchio said, it's like we never left. So even though it's a quick fire, Joe needs no encouragement. He's going to go pasta. Blue team's got some really interesting looking stuff. They've got, Karen kind of takes charge with this really. And by the way, I'm bullish on Karen. And she comes right out of the bat. Mm-hmm. Crispy artichokes with a mint vinaigrette with citrus segments. Love the mint citrus kind of combo there.
Especially when you got something fried, you want to brighten it up a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, because the mint gives you that sort of freshness. The citrus gives you the acid. And Nini comes out with artichoke tempura, one of two artichoke tempura dishes with, and she's got her Asian aioli, the fish sauce, chili oil, citrus combo. By the way, just a reminder of how excited I am to see Nini cook. We didn't get to see enough Nini last season. I am thrilled to watch her cook. And then you have the green team where you have that paper mache artichoke tempura by by Leanne.
Pancake tempura.
Oh my goodness. Oh, it looked like some Hungry Jack going on there. And then you have the artichoke crudo. I love that, and I don't mean to throw too much shade here, Tom, but I love crudo is now like kind of definition creep. That anything that just isn't fully prepared, we're kind of just tossing it on the plate as a crudo. And it's basically like, we're not going to do a hell of a lot with this ingredient. Let's just call it a crudo.
Yeah, I just had some goldfish crackers earlier. Is that a crudo? Just like a handful of goldfish?
Yes, that's not goldfish crudo. That is a crudo. So, interesting right off the bat. And again, the KISS system, the keep it simple, stupid. When you've got 15 contestants, what are the duds? Invariably, the duds are pasta and tempura, right?
Yeah, let me ask you about this, Kevin, because I feel like there is sort of an advantage to having a clock where you know I have 15 minutes. The other people, even though they get there first, they have more time to prepare. It's an uncertain clock that they're working with. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, I don't know how much of an advantage it is to get there first when, you know, I don't know if it's 45 minutes or if it's 30 minutes or if it's 15. That open-ended clock almost feels like a disadvantage to me. Maybe it mitigates the advantage somewhat. I just don't think that that is, I don't know, if I'm choosing how much time I want, an uncertain amount, I kind of feel like you want to have a little bit of a countdown.
You know, it's so you bring up a question I think we talked about with a lot of judges, which is one of the great questions for any Top Chef judge is, do you want the limitations, be it time, be it cooking technique and appliances, or do you want the 4 hours in the kitchen of a gourmet restaurant? You can just, you shop the day before you are planning the meal. And it is, and it's a theme that already surfaces. This is one of the, you've touched on one of the greatest sort of strategic and really just temperamental questions. Some chefs love the limitations. Some chefs don't. And actually true. And see, that's sort of, I think, where Joe, and we saw it in both the elimination, which we'll get to in the quick fire, where, you know, Joe has a repertoire where give him 3 hours to make a refined pasta.
He'll crush
Man,
it.
Man, Joe, there are a few people I want more than Joe Sasto in that situation. And because he has time to edit, you know. But sure, here's it yet again where the pasta, and look, no one's going to make pasta like him, but sort of confines himself to this truncated period of time. It ends up to be a little too rich. And again, with the tempura. Now, by the way, Nini nailed her tempura. Leanne didn't. But this was an interesting quickfire because you kind of got the sense that the best average dishes were the blue team. But if the judges did something interesting, they sort of chose the best dish. And it was that char-grilled artichoke with the sumac yogurt and tahini. I think it was suggested that Kevin Gillespie was the driving force behind that dish. And it elevates the red team. They sort of they get the... They get first, even though they had to suck Sasto's tortellino with the artichoke miso filling, but yep, they win.
So let's talk scoring here.
Yeah, this is a tough one. I felt for you, my friend.
So here's my thinking. Okay, they all won. So by the technical definition, they should each get 3 points because they won the quickfire. However, my feeling is, and if you feel differently, let me know. My feeling is we don't want Quickfire to outweigh the elimination challenge, but by giving out 3 points to each of the five contestants, we're giving out 15 points for the Quickfire. And I kind of feel like in normal circumstances, you give out 3 points for the winner and then 1 point each for those that were in the top three of the Quickfire. So that's 5 total points.
Right.
In this instance, my intuition is to give 1 point to each of the five contestants, especially because we don't know for a fact who was at the top or at the bottom. So we're not going to penalize Joe Sasto for having a bad dish. And we're also not going to give him 3 for having a dish that that we know the judges didn't like very much. So my inclination is to give 1 point for each of the five contestants rather than 3.
Yeah, it's a tough one because I think if you didn't know there was a formatted scoring system, I think you would have watched that segment and say the big winner was Gillespie. He spearheaded the winning dish. To some extent, you have to, as you say, provide the support staff and the team itself with some reward, even though Joe Sasto arguably had the worst dish of the day, right? And then I think you would also say, and I'm not begging for this, is not about my contestants, and I'm going to defer to your judgment on this, but you know, I feel badly for Nini. You know, she spearheads what might have been the second best dish of the day, and you know, if anyone's going to take, you know. Actually, you don't give a Quickfire bottom three, do you? You don't.
No.
Yeah, we don't.
No.
It's an interesting dilemma because, as you say, you don't want to distribute too many points because that then overweights the Quickfire. And while we think Kevin might have been the driving force and kind of the quote win, it was a team effort and it's a tough call. I mean, I defer to you. You always kind of operate fairly, so you do what you need to do.
I feel like it's 1 point for each because there's just a lot of ambiguity here. I agree with you. I think that Kevin had the best dish, but we just don't know who was helping to prepare that right.
So it does seem strange that somehow Sasto and Kevin would come out of the Quickfire with the same result.
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
Anyway, but I defer to you. You will make the trade call with the league and tell them what you want to do here and scoring call.
All right. How about this? I will do the 1 point for each winning team member. And then if people have a huge problem with this,
who are people, by the way, just you and me?
What?
Who are people?
If listeners.
Oh, listeners. Okay.
If listeners listeners out there who have a huge problem with the 1+1+1+1 or the 1 each for each of the Quickfire winners, let us hear it. I'm willing to hear people's ideas. So I'm going to go. My thinking was either 1 or 3 for each player, and I didn't realize that we might be doling out points differently within the winning team.
I mean, so my vote would be if we knew everything we needed to know, 3 to the spearheader of the best dish and 1 to the support to the other 4.
Yeah,
that would be my, but I there's no way of knowing. We think Gillespie was the catalyst of that dish, but we don't know.
But in this episode, I feel like we don't get as much behind the scenes because there's so much to get into.
Yeah.
So let's go with 1 for each and see how it goes. And if it feels worse after we record and into next week, maybe we can make an amendment. But so that is the Quickfire.
And so Tom, what happens next, I think, was one of the most fascinating segments of this episode. And that was, you and I had our own draft last week. But to watch the chefs draft was a fascinating exercise, right?
Because, and?
Right.
And the order in which they draft.
That was my point. Yeah, exactly.
Wait a minute. Kevin, why does Brian get the first pick?
I don't know. Why does Brian get the first? Although a snake draft, you know, first is also you get first, but you also get the bottom of the barrel too. So, I mean, I don't have a huge problem. In fact, I'd almost rather be like, I think I'd rather almost be, I don't want to be stuck with anyone. To me, there are a lot of good choices. I just want to make sure that I don't have, because if you pick last, you essentially say, I'm not going to get one of my bottom four. That's a pretty good piece of insurance, Tom.
There is. That is. But I'm wondering because, you know, back to the Quickfire scoring, do you think this is some sort of power ranking for how the judges viewed those dishes? Because the order that the judges went with
was Brian, Kevin, Jamie, Joe, and Melissa.
I'm going to guess they drew straws of some kind.
Yeah. No. I'd love to hear the backstory on that. So Brian goes with Eric.
Yeah, he goes with Eric. Now, that makes sense. Not only is Eric just insanely talented, but he worked for Veltaggio. They're both kind of Maryland, D.C. guys. Gillespie takes Jen Carroll. I think they were on a finale together. And, you know, apparently Jen has a real strength with seafood.
Yes, she cooked with Repair, and it was she's the seafood queen, as Kevin called her.
Jamie has an easy pick here, right? Like, you go with Gregory. He's the best chef in the competition. Easy call, in my opinion.
And Joe goes with Leanne.
I think that was a very interesting selection, because now you could argue, as we found out about Leanne, she is actually a producer on the show. So if anybody has I do think that offers a certain advantage, but I thought it was very interesting because don't forget, he had Nene if he wanted her, who was a contestant on her show. I mean, you know, Karen's out there, Stephanie's out there. So it was a very interesting selection. And then Melissa gets the snake, the bend of the snake. She takes, she takes Angelo and Karen, and she says something very interesting, Tom. This was about temperament and personality.
She wanted chill.
She wanted chill. And you know what she got? She got chill. And it was paid off. I mean, I think it's fair to say, and we don't want to get too far ahead, but it seems like they kind of came in second there in the final. So they were a fairly successful team. Then we snake around Malarkey, then Stephanie, and the final two were Nene and Lisa. I got to tell you, I was shocked Nene was ninth. Just absolutely shocked.
She didn't have much to work with in terms of track record. So maybe people are feeling like, hey, I know that she was successful in her 3 rounds or 3 weeks, but I just don't know enough about Nene.
I was absolutely not shocked that Lisa was 10.
She was last in ours.
Yeah. But this is what we got. We got right off the bat, the red team. Did you realize, you know, by the way, what was so interesting, and I was texting with our friend Mina Kimes the other night about this, you kind of, once you start airing the episodes, you realize how long it's been since we've seen, you know, we both concluded that we didn't remember Brian Veltaggio being as empirically attractive as he was. We didn't remember Brian Malarkey being as swishy as he was.
Yeah.
It was just kind of, there were all these flashbacks. It's like, really? Was that what this guy is like? And you realize, yeah, like 14 years ago, that's what the person was like.
Yeah, we always knew that Jen was, you know, spicy.
Right.
And she says she's grown up and she's different now. And everyone said the same thing. I want the person who says, yeah, I was better 12 years
than I was 14 yeah. years ago. I was an impressionable, differential
and hardened over the last year
with a lot
years.
Of hunger. And now I'm just now I'm somebody who rests on my laurels and basically I have no time for anybody. And, you know, and I become a curmudgeon in my old middle age.
Yeah. Everyone seems to be mellowed out.
Except Brian, because he's fucking bossy. And as you said earlier, he is calling the shots on Joe Sasto's team. The next thing you know, Joe Sasto is now saddled with having to make a New Haven clam pizza.
Shouts to Pepe's. Shouts to Pepe's. Yeah, yeah, I want to go to this. I went and jumped the gun earlier because I don't know. Maybe I'm not sleeping with a six-month-old here. But I realize, Joe, this was a premonition, a foreshadowing. He is the captain of this team. He picks Brian, and man, he probably has a lot of buyer's remorse there, right?
Yeah, I've got to believe so.
Because he sits there and takes it where he's just like, yeah, I guess we'll do the uni, which is great. I would love to eat pounds and pounds of uni, right? Like, I'm there. But the idea of, hey, you should do a flatbread. You should do a clam pizza. You should do all those things. How do you feel about that? Sounds good. All right, good. Ready to go. And as Leanne says, yada, 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 yada. And man, that must have been one of those moments where Joe was like, can we do a redo on this draft, please?
Yeah. I mean, Joe had a tough week. And, you know, I want to speak a little bit to flatbread for a second. Tom, we've debated. I don't think we've debated. Actually, I think we firmly agree that when you're at the early stages of the competition, a ton of contestants, you know, nobody likes to say they're a play it safe, but it does go back to, you don't have to outrun the bear. You just have to outrun the other guy. You don't even have to outrun like that many other guys. You just have to outrun one out of 13. And I understand that you come to this competition, it's go big or go home. But here's what I would ask, Tom. Is flatbread going big? What is the upside of flatbread? Are you going to win a competition with flatbread when half the competition has these well-composed seafood showcase dishes? Like, when is flatbread going to win a seafood competition? I would understand if you want to take a risk that is high risk, high reward. But to me, flatbread on an open fire, Tom Haberstroh, is high risk, low reward. I mean, at the end of the day, it's flatbread with some shit on it. Like, you're not, like, you know, pasta's one thing, right? Because, like, a great pasta, wow. And Joe showed us last season that a great pasta can often be the best dish in the competition. But I just, like, on a seafood open flame competition, what is the best flatbread is going to do? It's flatbread. You know, unless you're, by the way, Nancy Silverton. You know, is the only person and who was on that set who could win with flatbread. And I just don't understand. This seems to me low reward, high risk. You know, when Joe left the kitchen,
is flatbread a cousin of pasta? Like is this something that Joe was like, you know what? I if I'm going to go open flame, I'm not going to do a big meat. I'm just going to try to do a giant pasta.
Yeah, it's the cousin of pasta. If like the cousin's the one who's kind of on meth and like living out in, you know, the hinterlands, and that's your cousin, like that's the cousin it is. I mean,
rarely do I order a flatbread.
When is the last time? You and I go out a lot. I mean, when do you ever go to a place and say, I mean, look, you've got it, like Joseph Centeno has Bacco Mercat. And I don't know if we've gone there together and you've come to Los Angeles.
No.
Like he does the sort of Bacco, these very specific flatbreads. I mean, there are exceptions, but man, you're not going to win with flatbread. You're going to best get by with flatbread. And you might very well lose, especially if the kid, you know, if Sasto has a wood oven, like a you know, a coal fire, like speaking of Pepe's Pizzeria in New Haven, which we both love. If you got a coal fired oven, I get it. If you got some special apparatus that's going to enhance flatbread, I get it. But this just seems like a really odd week to come out of the gate with flatbread when you've got, you know, you looking over there and you got Gregory working with salmon. You got some scallops over there. You got people with tuna loin and the eye of the swordfish and Eric with a gorgeous looking prawn. Like, you're not going to win with flatbread. You can only lose with flatbread, Tom Haberstroh.
It was tough. That was a tough decision. I mean, Joe, again, was he cornered into that?
I believe
he might have said, I think it was Joe who said he was going to do a flatbread. And then Brian said, hey, clam pizza, clam pie. Now, I think also if you're going to do a flatbread, do you do a mayonnaise and uni topping, garlic mayonnaise and uni topping? I don't know. That seems just a lot of
goo.
Sogginess,
a lot of
right?
Goo.
Yeah. And look, I don't want to belabor the point on Joe's decision to go with flatbread, but fell flat.
Yeah, I might. And again, this is, I always on this show try to not play Monday morning quarterback with chefs because they're the chefs. But I just wonder, if I'm going to do a flatbread, it's going to be pesto. It's not going to be aioli. Like,
hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodles is like, yeah, whatever.
Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep. Free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order.
You know, and I think I would have gone that way. Like, there are ingredients that the flatbread can't accommodate. And I just don't know that the aioli is one of them. Brian, for his part, did a very nice-looking dish that I frankly looked fantastic.
Yes.
Spot prawn crudo, hibiscus ponzu, charred avocado. I got to tell you, he's bossy, but he came out of it well. And then you had Leanne with one of those dishes. I think, Tom, you and I on paper were like, shoya glazed halibut, charred corn, a miso beurre blanc. Uni,
you know, like it has all the textures there, the crispy on top, then you have the uni right underneath it on top of the halibut. Man, that is on paper a great dish.
Yeah, and we'll come back to it. Let's go to the grocery table. So the yellow team, Tom, and you gotta love, by the way, your boy Jamie's you know, kind of came out of the box pretty strong. I mean, I know he got dinged on the
ember front. The ember milk there was fantastic. I love that idea.
I am
that
dying.
Was brilliant.
We need to get Jamie on because I want to hear more about embers and cream. I never in a million years. Like, that's fantastic. Now, the yellow team delivered the meal we expected and deserved, says Nancy Silverton. Can I wax on Nancy for a second here?
Yes, please wax.
Nancy on. Silverton is a national culinary treasure. With Mark Peel, and I think they were a couple, and I think they've since split. She opened what might be one of the two or three most important restaurants in Los Angeles in the last 30 years. And that was Campanile on La Brea. It's the space now occupied by Republique. Next to it was La Brea Bakery. And apart from Spago, and you know, you can love Spago, you can hate Spago. It is a formative restaurant in Los Angeles's restaurant renaissance. But Campanile is right there with it. And I think she worked at Spago. But she is fantastic. And Campanile really got the ball running on a certain kind of like farmer's market cuisine. I think one reviewer back in the 90s referred to it as urban rustic, all the things we love. She then started the Mozza Complex. Have you been to Pizzeria Mozza or Osteria Mozza or Kispaka when you've come here, Tom?
No, I haven't.
All right. By the way, even though it's known for, you're talking about flatbreads, I mean, Mozza is a pizzeria. It also has my favorite dessert in Los Angeles, the butterscotch budino, Tom, with a little salt on the top. Best dessert in Los Angeles. But How hilarious was Nancy Silverton on the strawberry ambrosia?
Wow. Like,
who brings the jello mold to the potluck? She is hilarious. I hope we see her every week. She is a culinary treasure. I've always known that. What I didn't know is how brilliantly hilarious she is as a Top Chef judge.
She was amazing. And Jeremiah Tower, I kind of did a little bit of homework on him. His Wikipedia says he is one of the pioneers of the culinary style known as California cuisine. He is born in Stamford, Connecticut. Shout out
to
Stamford.
And by the way, could he be more waspy? Oh my God. He's like a headmaster in friggin' Dead Poet Society or something.
He attended Harvard University, earning a BA and then completing his MA at Harvard Graduate School of Design. Get this, okay? After earning a master's degree in architecture from Harvard University, he had intended to pursue design of underwater structures in Hawaii because of his obsession with finding the lost city of Atlantis.
That,
He looks like someone who has a crest, like his family crest is on his blazer, like a
the family seal, or was it called the family, like a family shield?
That is like in his pocket square, like on his the breast of his jacket. Like he is he was the guest judge, right? Yes,
he was. He was at the end, and
the staff of judges or the guests at this dinner was like having Larry Bird, Bill Russell, Oscar Robertson, Wilt Chamberlain, Kareem, LeBron, and Kobe Bryant, and Michael Jordan all at the same dinner.
Do you know what I learned is that Suzanne Gowen is far more introverted than I imagined she was. She is. She's incredible. She is my favorite chef. So, Tom, if you had to ask me, like, which chef inspired me to really take up cooking in Los Angeles, the answer is Suzanne Gowen. Aliza Miner, who was one of her sous chefs at AOC, was my tenant upstairs for many, many years in my duplex. And so I got to kind of get a peek into the Suzanne Gowen world. I had all her cookbooks. Aliza taught me so much about cooking. And I just love the simplicity. If you've ever been to Luke, it's one of those restaurants that was the hot place in the late 90s. Talk about urban rustic. It was very much in that spirit. A place now you can pretty much get a table when you want, but it's still awesome. AOC. She is a giant in farmer's market driven cooking in Los Angeles. Simple protein, really bright flavors, work with greens. I love you. If you've eaten at my house, Tom, chances are you've had something out of the Sunday suppers from Suzanne Gowen cookbook.
Mm.
So I'm with you, man. Like the judge, I was every bit as bowled over by the judge's table as the chefs were.
She just kept going. Padma was just like reading off the list. I was like, how many A-listers are we going to get here? Wow. And I believe it was Kevin who said, and here we have resurrected Christ joining
us. Right. Like Jesus Christ himself is going to be like, yeah, I didn't like the hibiscus. Yeah. So that was great. The yellow team rocked. I got to tell you something. Tom, Gregory is a monster. Like, I kind of feel like I'm watching like Warriors 15-16. Like, is he going to lose a challenge this season? Like, I know it's early, but talk about remorse for not having the one pick. Gregory is insane. Insane doing it with simplicity, right? Like, it's not like he's coming up with the molecular gastronomy. Look what I'm doing with this. I'm going to grill a piece of salmon to perfection. I'm going to have a whimsical little accompaniment that makes sense, grilled peaches. And then I'm going to balance that with some spice. Like he ain't reinventing the wheel here. He is just perfecting the wheel.
Man, that is a dish, like, as I'm hearing it, and I'm not just because I did the pepper challenge, but man, a habanero chili sauce with the grilled peaches and the salmon, sign me up. You know, it's not the most sophisticated dish. It didn't have any sort of, like you said, it didn't take a master scientist to pull off that dish, but even Jeremiah Tower's like, wait a minute, grilled peaches and salmon? I don't get it. And then blew their faces off with it. So Gregory continues his absolute trampling of this competition. He had 10 wins, 5 quick fire wins in the last season in season Boston, season 12 Boston, 5 elimination challenge wins, 5 quick fire wins, and then wins this episode. So, man, the win percentage on him is very much 2016 Golden State Warriors.
Tom, he is a monster. Now, I don't have a lot to be happy about in terms of my box score, but there were some silver linings. And I'll tell you one of my silver linings, Tom. I'm feeling very good about Stephanie right now.
Yes.
She did a prawn with charred tomato and charred corn, little crispy onion and potatoes. And all I was thinking, Tom, is this is a woman who understands what a challenge is. You're going to nail the protein. You're going to figure out which accompaniments are going to be most fire friendly. This is the sort of highlight of the challenge. We want you to use this open fire. You know what? Great. I'm going to char some tomatoes. I'm going to char some corn because that's what you char on an open grill. This isn't brain surgery. This is Top Chef. Recognize the contours of the challenge. Nail your protein. And you're good. And she made one of the four or five best dishes of the night or the day. And I am feeling really good about Stephanie. I think we're seeing she was sent home on a technicality, really bad luck. Nick Eltney kind of screwing her with the immunity. And this is a chef that very well could have been in a finale. If not for that, she is cooking well. She did good work in the quick fire. We saw she nailed this. She was on the winning team. She was a big part of the win. I'm feeling very good on a week that I don't have a lot to feel good about, Tom. I'm feeling very good.
I thought so didn't Tom Colicchio say that the winner of this would be the best average of the three dishes, or what was the criteria here? Because all three of these dishes were fantastic. And as Tom said, you know, the only fault that he could have was Jamie leaving out his mussels out to dry a little bit.
Yeah.
But the cream with the embers, that was brilliant, having it sliced through the colander. I love that dish. And what's funny is the only interaction that I've had with Jamie here in Charlotte, he was telling me about how he's just and this might be a great topic of conversation if we have him on, is he was using these giant motherfucking grills, like these huge grills that he was just out in the backyard. He was telling me all about it, how amazing it is. I was like, oh yeah, I got one of those Weber grills, charcoal grills. And he's like, I got to tell you, you got to get this giant grill. He was just talking about this. And I was like, wait a minute, this episode is exactly that. And I want to see what Jamie does. And he nailed it. It was an incredible dish. And then Stephanie, that dish that she did, I agree with you, is exactly kind of the, not the minimalist of a California cuisine dish, but she nailed it. We always talk about you want to have something that you can execute. And she executed it very, very well. Now, Gregory is on another level. Yellow, I thought Yellow would come out with the victory when they were lining him up. But man, Aqua had a good showing. Team Blue had a good showing. I don't know if we have time to go through every single one of these dishes, but Team Yellow was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, let's run through them real quick. I mean, so Aqua, you're right. Brian Voltaggio does the sable fish with corn porridge. A couple quick comments.
Not a good visual. Not a good visual.
And I have a couple comments. I mean, one is, here's what he did well. And I think we saw this with Gregory too. If you're going to grill fish, it's got to be fatty. You want salmon, you want sable fish, right? Like, you want a fatty fish if it's going to be on the grill. One of Leanne's problems wasn't just that weird oil flare up. Halibut is very delicate. It is a tough fish to grill. It is lean. It is delicate. Sablefish and salmon, that's where you want to be. And the other thing I think we learned from Brian is, to your point, you need to watch the mushy textures. Judges on this show do not take kindly to it. You hear comments like baby food, mush, the dish was muddled. You have to be careful with your porridges, with your polentas, with your starchy purees. They like crunch. You always hear Gail say, I love the crunch. And Brian's got to watch that, because I'm telling you, like, it happened in a couple of different dishes on this show. You got to watch the mush. Eric, keep it simple. He kept it simple. He came with flavor and simplicity, the Chesapeake boil. Lisa, by the way, you know, we've been dumping on Lisa a little bit. You know, Tom loved it. You take you char your shrimp and your scallop, you cut them up, you put some other elements, you got to serve it cold. You and I are both fans of the ceviche from living in Miami. She nails it.
It's hard to do a ceviche or a crudo in on a open wood fire grill, right? Like, that is a tough dish to pull off in the heat. You got to keep it super cold, and it sounds like they did a good job here.
Yeah, I mean, I think give it up to Lisa. She nailed it. Green, again, we saw it was sort of the no assholes theory. I'm going to assemble a team with nice people. Angelo had a texture problem. His oyster with congee. Tom was not a fan.
Phlegmy.
And you and I love oysters,
baby food.
Too. Yeah. Phlegm was not. Phlegm is, that's a really unappealing thing to talk about in terms of food. But Melissa, I think Melissa had a great week, Tom Haberstroh. Swordfish yep. with a hot and sour sauce and those charred chicory, radicchio. I mean, and people just love that. Again, what she kind of went, she and Stephanie, nailed the protein. The grill is the featured quality and feature.
Did she throw the whole head of radicchio in the
the embers? Yeah. I mean, wow. I love charred chicory is wonderful, and it was wonderful. Mm. And then Karen, my girl Karen, again, grilled scallop with a ginger plum. As Gail Simmons said, she showcased the protein, but got some of that brightness in. Green did very well, Angelo notwithstanding. And then the blue team, you know, if not for Kevin, who had the most visually stunning dish with the swordfish eye braised in that chorizo olive and pea thing. Nancy Silverson said it was a cover shot. Unfortunately, it was regarded as a disaster. Hard to know. But Jen Carroll, with the lunchy tuna loin with grilled kale. I mean,
looked awesome. Yeah.
Again, they swooned.
Yeah. Everyone said I would have that dish every day for lunch if I could. And you know, she nailed her dish. I want to go back real quick to Angelo. Okay. The oyster on a bed of porridge.
Again, texture.
What, like, you're in heat, you're in the summer, what looks like to be the summer of Los Angeles. And real quick, what beach were they at? And can you give me just kind of a scouting report on where they were?
Well, they said San Pedro. So you'd be down closer to Long Beach, Palos Verdes. That is sort of an away game for me. San Pedro is actually nice because there's actually an old Greek community there. And you know, it's where Longshoremen and had this very, you know, like the fish lady that I buy from at the Hollywood Farmers Market, Marilyn. Hello, Marilyn, if you're listening. She comes up from San Pedro. So it's
got to be hot out there. Yeah. It seemed like there was a sweaty day.
That's what's funny. I mean, the thing about LA that I don't think people realize is it's rarely hot at the beach. It can be warm, but the Pacific Ocean is natural air conditioning, and it is very uncommon to go to the beach on a summer day and it being even a little chilly, you know, like, or just certainly not hot. So I was kind of surprised. It might be one of those beaches that's southern facing, which means it will be a little hotter. But
if you're going to do an oyster, Kevin, like,
you gotta chill that shit.
Gotta chill it. You can't put it on some porridge. It just didn't, that dish did not make sense to me. And I'm a big fan of Angelo, but that one, whenever you're described, your food is described as phlegmy, not a good sign. And also, Angelo, props on the dad joke. Did you catch that in there?
Oh, shucks.
How's it going over there, Angelo?
Aw, shucks.
Shucks. And man, just nailed it. And there was a nice little vignette about him as a father, and just nailed that dad joke. So shouts to Angelo with that one. Now, the Leanne pouring the oil and burning the getting all carbony on her dish. You know, one of those bonehead moves, of course. But man, can we just have a 30 minutes of Nene fanning a fire? It's amazing. That was an amazing little segment there of Nene just delicately fanning a fire. Kevin coming over and be like, "This is how you fan a fire." And she's like, "Yeah, that's right. You got a beard. You must know how to make a fire and grill." So I love those moments, you know, with so many people in the show, this early in the show, you're not really getting a lot of backstory, the soap opera-ness of Top Chef that you saw, you know, when Lisa's just chewing out Marcel or Dale. Like, we don't get a lot of that on this early in the show. But I love the little scenes that they showed, and the food all around, I thought, was really strong, really strong. And of course, with an all-star cast, you should be expecting that. But I got to say, I was surprised that Kevin's dish was overcooked, because this is a grill master. I really feel like Kevin would have done this better, you know, 9 times out of 10. It was just that 10th time that he overcooked his dish. It looked fantastic. That was a surprise to me, but man,
yeah,
they were all really strong.
Yeah. Nene. I mean, Nene is, I took a
perfectly
real shot
scout.
On her. Perfectly
cooked
scout, the charred Brussels sprout. She's in it. She's in it to win it. So Where are you on your team? You must be feeling good. You racked up a ton of points. You know, Gregory justified his number one pick. You know, you got yourself some Voltage. You got Do I have Voltage? No, you have Voltage.
I got Voltage. Here's my team.
You got Voltage and Eric, both of whom showed well.
Gregory, Eric, Brian, Melissa, Jen, Leanne, Jamie. That's my team. Your team, Kevin, Nini, Karen, Joe, Stephanie, Angelo, Brian, Malarkey. So I come out with 26 points after this week. If we're doing the one per contestant in the quickfire winning team, 26 to 10, Kevin. It wasn't your strongest week, but I will say Stephanie showed out for you.
Yeah, Stephanie showed out. I love what I see from Karen. You know, again, this was one of those situations where, you know, the scoring doesn't always reflect, right? I mean, we've got, you know, like, for instance, you know, not everybody who had the best dishes necessarily got points.
And yeah, it was a weird episode. When you have a lot of teams, when you have a team effort, you don't, you know, like when Tom is at the judge's table and he's describing some of his favorite dishes and they're not on the winning team, I kind of sit there. I'm like, you know, this is where we've talked about on the show a bunch that team play can kind of, even though it's kind of a gimmick you have to do when you have 15 contestants, it's not a meritocracy. If someone has a great dish on a shitty team, they're not going to be the winner, even though all else equal, they're the winning dish.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like being on the floor with Chris Paul. You know, there's guys who do it for a couple seasons. You think they're really amazing, and it turns out their field goal percentage was as reflective of him as it was of them. That's what I think. But so in a certain sense, like, I don't love the, you know, looking up at the scoreboard this morning, but I have to say, you know, I'm liking what I see from Karen. I'm liking what I see. Nini had the second best dish in the quick fire. She nailed her elimination dish. You know, Kevin, I'm not worried about, right? Like, he kind of laid an egg with the swordfish, but I think the concept was right there. And this is not a guy I worry about fucking up his proteins every week, right? Like, he's going to be a force to be reckoned with. I'm loving what I'm seeing from Stephanie. I don't know how long Angelo is for this competition, Tom, to be honest with you. And you know what, Brian? He put together
which,
a nice
which Brian?
Video.
Which
Malarkey?
Which Brian? Malarkey, yeah.
Yeah, so like, I got to tell you, the score doesn't look great this morning. Joe was a disappointment. There's nobody else other than Angelo. I'm a little concerned that you know, he will be out shortly. But I'm feeling okay about these others.
I get to give a shout out here to Vince Mancini, who does the power rankings on Up Rocks for Top Chef power rankings. And it's a great read every week. And the way he described Brian Malarkey is fantastic. He said he also has this odd way of speaking where it looks like he's over enunciating, but all of his words come out under enunciated, which was fantastic. I read that and I was like, yes, that's exactly what it is. Brian Malarkey just nailed that description on Up Rocks. And I think, when you look at the power rankings that he has, I disagree on a couple of them, but
Nini at 10? Come on.
I know. But you know, when I read this, it's a great read. And I giggle probably 10 different times. But I will say this on the rest of the show. If I can go back, Eric Ajapong, okay, when he is talking about how he's going to box out everybody and he's going to get to the proteins but before everybody, talking a big game. And then he's got to learn his boxing out skills. He got boxed out. And I thought Eric, being the athlete that he is, and he's a huge Knicks fan, that he's going to be a Charles Oakley underneath there. He's going to be Ron Harper just throwing elbows to get to his protein. And then he comes back to Lisa and is like, this is all I got. Come on, Eric. Like, come on, throw out some elbows out there. So he, I was disappointed in that. And that 3 seconds of them running to the table, as Angelo called it, the running of the bulls. I thought Eric was going to just like, clear it out. But yeah. And other notes I had here for the episode, Brian Voltaggio, it kind of feels like he's the dad or the coach of this cast. Don't you get that feeling where like everyone's not worshiping him, but kind of feeling like he doesn't belong here. Like he's too good for this. Cause doesn't he like give the, he went and did the toast.
He was
out
toast
on the
master,
back
yeah.
deck. He did the toast like, hey, everybody saw you, been watching you. You're doing a great job. And I just want to say, it's great to be cooking here with you all. And I'm sitting here. I'm like, I feel like Voltaggio is overqualified for this competition. Doesn't mean he's going to win, but it does feel like that that guy who comes back to play varsity basketball, comes back to practice. He's been playing college ball for 2 years, and he comes back to the practice and just whoops everybody. And you're kind of like, this isn't fun. Like, we know you're better than us. But Gregory might be the equalizer here. Gregory might just like wipe the floor with Brian. So I just kind of felt like Voltaggio, given the fact that he's already been a judge on Top Chef, as Eric described, kind of getting these vibes that maybe they're setting us up for an early out for Brian, but he just feels like he's the dad or the coach of this group.
All right, let me ask you, I'm gonna put you on the spot, Tom. Who goes farther for you, Voltaggio or Eric?
Oh man.
You had to take one. If you had to take one, what you know after week one, who you got?
Oof, that's a good. You know what? I'm reading too much into the production side. I'm gonna go with Eric is gonna outlast Brian here. And you know what? I picked Eric before Brian.
Yeah, you did. Yeah. You did.
So I still feel good about Eric over Brian.
I got no qualms about Eric. I mean, again, the Nene Eric 3-4 pick will be. I don't know that I'll ever have a harder choice on this competition. There's just something about Nene. I just feel like she. I mean, we didn't get to see anything. I mean, the only thing we know she doesn't do well is run the front of the house. All we ever see are wins. And again, she was essentially a co-winner on this quick fire. She, you know, had as good a dish. She could have been on a winning team and we'd be talking mm-hmm. about her in different terms. I just feel like, you know, maybe if I have to defend that's a problem. I just feel like everybody, I mean, I'm looking at our friend Vince's power rankings here. She's sitting at number 10. I'm thinking, what are you thinking, my friend? She is.
So if I had Nene on my team,
yeah,
you'd be trying to trade for her.
Probably.
Yeah.
I wouldn't.
Anyone on my team that you were kind of like, I wish I had them on my team.
Yeah.
Right,
you know, I mean, look, I had a choice between Joe Sasto and Melissa King, and boy, do I feel silly right now. You know, I would say that, that was, and that was on my board, right? Like I sandbagged Stephanie because I knew you didn't have any interest. I just kind of knew she's not your kind of contestant. And I knew I could probably get around to the 10. I figured you wouldn't have her higher than 10 on your board. So I kind of sandbagged her, even though I had high hopes. But Melissa, I'm having real buyer's remorse right about now. I just think she was a young chef and she played well. Now she's a seasoned chef and she knows exactly what the fuck she's doing.
All right. Trade call.
All right.
Melissa King. I'm offering Melissa King for Stephanie Seymour and Angelo Sosa.
Right, but that leaves me with
one fewer,
though.
How bad do you want Melissa?
Not that bad.
Okay.
I mean, not that bad. I mean, the one for twos, just to give you a little scowl
you
on did, me.
You said you... you
I'm not
you
a didn't... one for two guy, because here's the thing. Those are still points, right? Like Angelo's... I mean, unless you think that Angelo is a negative... I'm getting
well,
zero
points.
Well,
you said points. You thought, you know what? You showed your cards in saying that you didn't think he was long for this competition. So I'm acting like he's a throw-in into this.
Let's go to the scoring system here. So if let's say I thought he was going to be eliminated the next 2 weeks. Let's go to the scoring system here. So elimination is -5. So let's say I think he's going to get eliminated. And he probably has maybe a top three quick fire. Let's just price him in for he's on a winning team or some shit. Or even he gets lucky. All right. So that would be -4. And then if he finished middle, like let's say he finished middle the next 2 weeks and then got eliminated and had a top three. So you're right. Like if I don't think he's much for this competition, what I'm basically saying is he might be a net zero over the next several weeks, next 3 weeks. I mean, it's an interesting proposition. Look, I like Stephanie. I like Melissa. I don't know that I like Melissa any more than I like Stephanie. I think Stephanie's a Final Four player. Melissa's just stronger than I... You know, looking back, I probably should have had her higher on the board.
All right. Well, you know, I just wanted to connect with you on that trade. You can always come back to it and counter. You know, I just wanted to kind of send the feelers out, just kind of get that conversation going.
I mean, a pick swap. Pick swaps I kind of like as currency. I like pick swaps.
So a straight up Stephanie and Melissa with a pick swap, you're more amenable to?
Yeah, I'd be more amenable to that. I mean, I don't know. Like I just, giving up a contestant is just giving, I mean, as you say, like the net contestant, even the average contestant, even the below average contestant still nets points, right? I mean,
right. And remember, Last Chance Kitchen, you do have the ability to rack up.
That's
points.
True. That's true. That's true. I just don't have a lot of faith in Angelo right now. I'm feeling a little like, you know, he'd be kind of falling out of the rotation if I were an NBA coach. I don't know. I'm not feeling good about that. I think you should be feeling good about Jamie. I think you should be feeling good about Jen Carroll. I got to tell you, I got a little team envy right now.
Yeah. Well, so fire up the trade machine, Kevin, on the off season, on the off week. In between episodes, you can fire up the trade machine, send me some trade options, and then we can revisit.
All right, Tom, we got 14 contestants left. We got a free agency call in a couple weeks. We got a lot going on. I'm very excited.
It's a great, great first episode. You know, I think Gregory is the far and away the favorite at this point.
I mean, I don't know that I can recall a season where I felt more confident about the favorite. He's just, it is Gregory and it is everybody else.
Yeah. What is the best championship loser of all time?
Blaze, like, coming in second.
No. I'm saying in the NBA, is it the 04 Lakers? Like, what's the most dominant team? It's the 2016 Warriors. Yeah. 2016 Warriors.
Yeah.
Like Gregory is the 2016 Warriors, where he wasn't the number one. He didn't win his season, but I kind of feel like he's an all-timer.
Yeah, I think some of those Spurs teams also, like 13 was just ridiculously good.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the Heat were the Heat and that crazy finish. Also, like, you're going to say, you know what other team? The 15-16 Spurs.
Spurs.
I mean, even though, I mean, they won 67 games. It's just, yeah. I mean, they were awesome.
That was the Kawhi Leonard ankle, right?
Was that the year or was the next?
I think Zaza, wasn't it?
Was that 17 though?
It might have been 17.
It might be.
I think Zaza was a 17. Yeah, because 16 didn't have Zaza.
Yeah, the 10-11 Spurs. I mean, basically like half of the Spurs teams. But anyway, all right, Tom, I'll take us out. I'm looking forward to it. For Tom Haberstroh, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.